Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to an all-new episode of Articulate Warbling with I, Zach Ferguson, and...
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Articulate Warbling. I wanted to introduce
Oh, fuck.
Anyway, yes, it's with Zach and me, Laura.
And it is going to be an all-sorts episode where we will be deep delving into deep discussions, which basically are bloomed on out by our recent viewings, and that will be... centred upon Werner Herzog's documentary, The Grizzly Man. Also, the recent Netflix documentary that is like, I think it's like number one worldwide.
It's definitely trending hard.
Trending hard, ironically, and this is called The Social Dilemma. We'll also be chattering about our recent viewings at the local theatre, cinema. And also just... as I said, all sorts, but not of the licorice variety. So, show, where shall we start? Where shall we go? Laura, take lead, please.
I'd just like to start this very quick conversation about all sorts and your mention of licorice. There is, in fact, a man who has recently died.
I was just going to bring that up.
From eating a hell of a lot of licorice all sorts.
In a space of a week.
Yeah, he ate a lot and he died. Anyway, rest in peace.
Licorice man.
Licorice man. I mean, I don't know what's wrong with you. I hate licorice, but whatever. I just thought we'd start with that. So let's start with our recent cinema viewing, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll kick it off with the Broken Hearts Gallery, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay, so Broken Hearts Gallery, are you happy for me to do a little
synopsis?
Yeah, synopsis?
Please do, because I'm shit at them.
Broken Hearts Gallery is basically about a girl who collects small... totally inanimate objects, really, from every relationship she has, which is kind of like an emotional crutch, almost as if she needs something to remember because she has to rely more on her past than worrying about her future. Or
and
at least,
hasn't.
That's how I took it.
That's definitely it.
And then she turns that compulsion into a gallery where other people can bring their small, inanimate, and big inanimate objects to be remembered.
And passed on to allow themselves to move on.
Yeah, in wake of a relationship. So,
and for it to be recognised. And you get very multiple strands of different people's stories, some more affecting than others, others even more hilarious than others.
Like the woman who had her cast. Her broken ankle.
Yeah, and it was to do with her wanting having a tattooed leg, but the tattoos weren't on offer, weren't being viewed, so she drew their own tattoos onto it. And then she's like, it's old and it smells. The Broken Hearts Gallery, like a lot of films recently, have just randomly and sporadically, with no preamble or actual any publicity, have been shoved on screen. Because in the wake of COVID, a lot of independent films that have been shelved or were just certain like fillers up in the... you know, the lineup, like, we have this big movie and then we have these small movies. Well, at the moment, all these small movies are getting... luckily enough, the undivided attention, not that the numbers or box office are proving that, no one's going to the cinema. I've kind of up and down about whether you should go. I believe that you should, but adhere to all guidelines and rules. You need to save these industries, because otherwise we're all going to be forced to fork out 18 quid a month for the likes of Netflix or Amazon, which looks like the direction that the cinema is going.
But I think also we do need to bear in mind people's anxieties around catching this disease, virus.
No doubt.
And we do need to protect ourselves. But I think the most important thing from our point of view is, look, if you're feeling well enough to do it, both mentally and physically, you've got no symptoms, and you make sure that you do adhere to the guidelines, you're wearing a face mask, you're using antibacterial gel, I think it's okay to go to the cinema and enjoy a film, because when all is said and done, there aren't a lot of people there.
Currently, no.
It is very easy to social distance in the cinema.
Yeah.
And if you're more comfortable doing so, it's easier perhaps to sit at the back, whereas people sit closer to the front, and to kind of get through it that way. I am very specific about not really wanting to sit behind or in front of someone, because I don't like the fact that there may be 6 foot between the two seats next to me, but there's not 6 foot or 2 meters, whichever way you want to look at it, in front or behind me.
Yeah.
So you can work it out that way. And I think the best thing to do is actually to keep an eye on how the seats are looking and book relatively late in the day. Before it starts, so that you can almost guarantee that there won't be too many that join you afterwards.
It's not just about getting the numbers in for the filmmakers, because you know they have an out, they have like a write-off scheme, all big studios do. Cinemas don't have that luxury.
It's the cinemas that we're trying to save here, not the film industry.
No, the film industry is never going to crash and burn.
It will always continue. I mean, it will continue on streaming sites.
I mean, yeah, the actors cry and going, you need to save the cinema. Yeah, for the likes of your piggy bank.
Yeah, because instead of getting 50 million, they're probably only going to get about 35,
right? Yeah.
I'm sorry,
didn't. I'm sorry, Robert Downey Jr. or whomever's film's coming out. I mean, Christopher Nolan, I mean... 120 million is a lot of money to put towards your own film. But anyway, Broken Hearts Gallery.
Geraldine Viswanathan.
Who's the main actress?
Who is the main actress?
Is sensational.
And she's stunning.
Beautiful. And what I loved about this film is we live in a world now where there's polarisation when it comes to cultures, ethnicities, everything. There's polarisation over everything. And certain studios adhere to a certain thing. They're reactionary. Let's have a all-black cast for the sake of having a black cast, whilst trying to make an apparent point, whereas it sticks out like a sore thumb and it's disingenuous. Whereas this is a natural film cast...
It wasn't cast as if, oh, we must have a black person in here. It was just cast because that person fit really nicely.
And she isn't your traditional, she's of mixed...
She's Indian. So, as far as her colour's concerned, she looks mixed race.
She looks mixed race. She has quite an apparent scar on her face. She's rather curvaceous. And it doesn't fit the usual blueprint for romantic comedies. And that's why I love it. Also... she's so charming, so beautiful. It's so easy to know why people would so easily fall in love with her, but also take advantage
of
that.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because she's kind of almost immature, naive.
Yeah.
But I love that. Just kind of ignorant to the overall world and how things work.
And then when it goes to shit, her natural inclination is to react naively, childishly.
Yeah.
Which we benefit from, because it's some hilarious sequences, like when she's like running into the restaurant with the bags full, and the whole thing of her jumping in the taxi cab, and that's where she meets the Nick, and she's
Baker Montgomery,
and it's just, I love it. I love the film. 5 stars for the casting, for the naturalness of it, for, you know, not adhering to certain blueprints of God. It's just a naturally evolved, subtle film.
And the thing is, for me, I mean, I don't think I said this before on Articulate Warbler, but it's a conversation I've had with many people. I hate...
You've mentioned it a few times on Articulate Warbler.
I hate romantic comedies. I think they are always too sickly sweet. They're predictable. There's always this lovely Hollywood ending that never fucking happens. Now, I think the difference is, and this is going to sound even more smushy than a romantic comedy, is that we go to watch a smushy romantic comedy because we haven't got that love in our life, and we kind of want to laugh and feel sad with that main character who's having all these issues in their life. And actually, for the first time, I've watched a romantic comedy and really enjoyed it, because actually, although it is smushy and cutesy, it's like, actually, I've got that love, so I don't have to
feel relatable, and I don't have
to feel jealous anymore.
And it's subtle. The only thing that I felt jealous of and a little bit displaced was, but it's also the strength of the film, the three main leads outside of the male co-star is the friendship group, which is their on-screen chemistry, their relationship. I sat there and I wish I had friends like that.
So that was, I can't remember their names. Was it Philippa Sue?
Mm-hmm, it's one of them.
And Molly Gordon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So her two...
All of them together.
And I think as well, what I really liked, because I hate the fact that we have to, nowadays, to fit in with certain things and tick boxes, we have to have a lesbian relationship, we have to have a gay relationship, we have to have a person
tick
of
those
African,
boxes, yeah.
African
that's what
descent.
That's what I mean about them, like, strategizing, like, oh, we're not seen on side. You see it from studios, it's a ripple and a crest,
yeah,
and it's
exactly.
just disingenuous.
Exactly.
You're not casting based upon talent, you're casting because you want to fit that criteria.
It's ticking boxes.
And here, it's just naturally evolved. There's
no
alternate agenda behind it. It is a naturally evolved, well-written, well-directed, beautiful, kind of soppy, but really well-intended, big-hearted movie.
But this is what I loved about the different friends, because you've got this girl, you know, Lucy, played by Geraldine Viswanathan, and she is, she's the kind of almost idiotic, clumsy friend, isn't she? And then you've got the other friend who's a bit more of a, she's a model. She's she sleeps around with a lot of girls, you know. She's lesbian, but not in that traditional, we have to put a lesbian in
well,
here.
Well, the other one has a boyfriend who's just dead silent.
But that's what I mean, is what it shows, is the girl, the one girl that's manipulated by men. And then the other friend, who's a girl, who has this boyfriend, who's almost manipulative herself of her boyfriend. Because it's like, shut up, don't talk, I talk on behalf of both of us sort of thing. And actually,
but it's quite nice, an endearing, realistic, funny, relatable way that you see within social circles. No, it's very self-aware of what it is. And she's also really quirky and kooky. Like, you can see that she's got a glint behind her eyes that she would cut a bitch if you hurt her friend, of which there's a hilarious sequence where they, like, basically, at near the end of the film, are quizzing the main lead and they're, like, chopping the vegetables up and, like, you know.
Yeah, they're saying, just to let you know, if somebody falls off the off the roof, then we're not going to know anything about it, and we don't know what you're talking about.
I just think the writing, the chemistry on screen, and also obviously behind the cameras, they all got along. It's just a beautifully envisioned film, and also something that's very touching and very, like we've spoken about Laura's mum before. She goes to the cinema to escape. It's a great escapism. This movie for me is pure escapism into this fantastical but also so relatable and subtle world of love, heartbreak. And heartbreak of all kinds, family-related, like when there's a big reveal at the end, everything slots into place. It's just a well-thought-out, beautifully envisioned movie, and I'm really taken by it, and I think it's one of my favourite viewings of this year. So, you know, it's a movie that, you know, people will write off as being, you know, mote, samesy, blamesy, but it's got something behind it, and I think it's the main actress's quirk and her friendship group and the way they handle this. Every character is a little bit OTT and a bit pantomimed, but it's so more relatable for that sake. You know what I mean? We've all had friends at some point who are that character beyond characters. I'm talking for myself. I was always known as the hyperactive dickhead in my friendship group. So it's so interrelated and relatable, and it's beautiful. I personally came out thinking, you know what, it's my favourite film of the year, and it is.
Mm. It was nice to see Bernadette Peters in it as well, the ginger lady, who is 72 now. And does not look 72.
No.
It was good to see her. She hasn't been in much a lot lately.
I don't know what she's from.
She did a lot of Disney films. So she did Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella, Anastasia, and Annie. And she's done...
Anastasia was 20th Century Fox, but she has done a lot of Disney films. Was it voice work?
Yes.
It's nice to know that she's actually now got an on-screen presence as herself. And you know what? She's a... Granny, I'd like to boop a gif. But anyway, it's pure escapism. It's something to snuggle up to, especially if you're in the UK now. Something to, like, go out wrapped up in jumpers, snuggling into your...
Definitely a hot chocolate with whipped cream situation, isn't it?
I mean, like, if you can get that at a cinema near you, do it. It's just like if you're in the UK, wrap up, go out for an evening meal, go out for an evening popcorn sesh, and just enjoy this movie. 5 stars for me, I love it. It's just, it hits all those marks, beautifully photographed. And, you know, with the tropes and the stereotypes inherent in any romantic comedy, it subverts it in a really spectacular way, and it's by the compelling, charismatic, hilarious cast. I would love to see these ladies, not in the same characters, but to see where else in a different environment or genre they can work together. Mm. It's a beautiful pairing, terrific cast, and I think the casting director
A
commendation, or possibly even at the Oscars, an Oscar, because it's so difficult to find that popping fire, that zest of on-screen chemistry. Sometimes in romantic comedies, you're like, there's no zest, there's no fire.
And the thing is, it's not funny half the time.
No.
I find romantic comedies really not funny, really boring.
Yeah. I like it doesn't fit the trend of bleach blonde, ditzy,
exactly.
Trip over.
She was still kind of clumsy in that sense, but not like that blonde.
But it was
ski.
Just bubbly and quirky, and it fit the bill of what it was. So, yeah. How many stars for yourself, Gordon?
5 stars.
5 stars. 5 stars from me. A recommendation to see The Broken Hearts Gallery.
Okay, so let's move on to Road to Not Taken.
Mm.
Is it Elle?
Elle Fanning.
Elle Fanning. To which, when it came up, I'm like, as in, like, Dakota Fanning's sister? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, shit, I was joking. and Javier Bardem, who, I know he's a bit old for me now, but yummy, yum, 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 yum.
I mean,
he's like gravy on a roast dinner, man.
I mean, he is. There is something about him.
His voice as well.
He's that voice. And also, you know, he looks like Jeffrey Dean Morgan if he, like, fell off a fast-moving car. But
yeah,
you like him for it.
That's true.
You like
he's
him
rugged,
for it.
Isn't
he's more
he?
Rugged than Jeff. You wouldn't imagine anyone more rugged than Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Well, look at Javier Bardem.
I think it kind of goes Gerard Butler, like, in the mix of, like, going from smooth to rugged. I think it goes Gerard Butler, then
Jeffrey Dean Morgan,
and then Javier Bardem.
Because it's literally... But I think you would always go for Javier Bardem. Also, he's Spanish, and it's sexy.
There's something about Spanish, Hispanic. Yeah. That feel is just sexy, isn't
I know,
it?
I mean, he's appealing enough because he's with one of the most beautiful women on this planet, Penelope Cruz.
Exactly, but I think as well they're known, you know, Spanish people, Hispanics, they're very known for being hippie, dancing, and sexual, aren't they? Not in a... over the top way, but they are just quite
there's
sexual
an allure.
Beings.
They can be that mysterious character, there's an allure there, and not to sorry, we're sexualizing you, Javier. But the thing is, Javier also is an actor of.
He knows he's yummy. Come on,
he knows he's yummy, but he's also he's a sensational actor. He does fuck loads, whether it's big Hollywood films like Pirates of the Caribbean or Skyfall, or the likes of an indie film like this by Sally Potter, The Road's Not Taken. He has such a wide, diverse range, or even in his own native tongue, independent movies like Beautiful and all such and sundry. But I saw this trailer to this film as a recommendation via Cineworld, because this is one of the lineups that they were going to thrust out, and I went, it looks shit. It looks boring, it looks dull, but I read up about it. I'm interested in Sally Potter as a creator and an artist. I love Javier Bardem. Elle Fanning is, you know, the Fanning sisters. She's the royal supreme now of that family. Dakota had her fame when she was in, like, 10, 11. Elle Fanning has just blown out. Yeah. And also, what's really nice to see with Elle Fanning, she's like Javier Bardem. She's that name. Yeah. She can go back and she can decide to do little projects like this. And I think The Road's Not Taken is nearing, for me personally, up alongside with what we have seen, which is very few this year, Invisible Man, The Broken Hearts Gallery, and this film is probably my favourite viewings of this year. This film...
And Baby Teeth, I really like Baby Teeth.
Baby Teeth is up there as well. Yeah. But there's something about this movie, so do you want
me to just give you a quick
synopsis? Do a quick
synopsis,
please.
Javier is the main character alongside Elle Fanning. So Javier plays a character, Leo, who has dementia, but we don't know that straight away.
It's very unclear, isn't it?
And Elle Fanning is his daughter, which is kind of a little bit disconcerting until you meet her mother, which is Laura Linney, who I'm really pleased, just quickly, just to kind of go off, I'm really pleased to see her back because I haven't seen her since Love Actually.
I mean, Laura Linney has been in very few films, but she's been killing it on a Netflix series called Ozark for a good 3 years.
Yeah,
so her,
she's enough.
Found a placement in television now, whereas I think the last time personally I saw her was
Love Actually, and I really liked her in that.
And perfect casting because they're very similar.
Yeah, very similar.
Aesthetically.
Anyway, yeah, so he's got dementia, she is his daughter.
Unofficial carer.
Yeah, and it's just basically about a day in their life, but they've made 83 minutes worth of it, which is a fantastic way of doing it.
And it's swooping and broad, isn't it?
And yeah, so they basically, she tries to take him to the dentist and she takes him to get his eyes tested, and then she returns home and then he disappears. In the middle of the night.
So many little little vignettes of a day in their life, but whilst it's a day in their life, in the present, we also go back to a time before his daughter even existed. Also,
absolutely.
There's a middle ground here where, for a certain time, we believe that we are part of a memory, but actually it's a fantasy.
Yeah.
It is a correspondence between the present woes and the past woes combining together with his dementia and his condition. And it's kind of like we're seeing within, without. We are seeing the mapping of his... It's very ingenious how we see this... almost catatonic state, and then he's in. He is a man who's on cloud nine. He's in his own vista of reality, and like with loads of dementia sufferers, they live in the past. Also, I love that ambiguous fantasy realm where you're kind of trying to figure out. There's a little slight clues in there. It's fantasy with references to I'm on exile on this island. I haven't seen my daughter in 20 years. And you're going, 1 minute, but your daughter is so close to you. Mm. Like, papa, papa, she's so nurturing to you. And I think that the visual vista and the cinematography and just the execution of it editorially, script-wise, Sally Potter with her really sonorous score, which she did herself, it's beautifully put. I think it's the most beautifully envisioned way to capture a day in the life of someone with dementia from within and without.
I think what's interesting is I won't ruin the storyline because it hasn't been out for that long, really, and there are probably quite a few people that still haven't seen it, but we mourn at times for Nesta. Mm. And we don't realise quite who Nesta truly is, which is interesting. And also, for me, I've worked with people with dementia.
Yeah.
I've cared for people with dementia. And it's come from a place, it's very obvious that it's come from a place of knowledge.
Mm.
There's been a lot of research into how this kind of thing works. And from that point of view, not only was it a happy but sad film, but also it came from a real heartache from someone somewhere, and the way it was acted, the way it was portrayed by Javier as the person with dementia, by Elle as the person outside of that trying to understand, was so incredibly perfect and aligned to how it truly is in real life. And everybody who has dementia suffers in different ways,
yes,
and has different symptoms, a bit like other things in life, autism being one of them. But you know, those kind of traditional stereotypical symptoms of walking around in the night thinking you're somewhere else and leaving,
stealing someone's dog in the middle of a store, thinking it's your barely dearly beloved dog, Nesta's,
and also thinking that you have to be somewhere when in fact you don't.
In
and
real I've, time it's no, no
and
relation.
I've seen that in a gentleman that I used to look after, and he used to say to me every morning, I have to go to work now, I need to catch the train. He says, tell me which way to the train station, because he knows in his head that he has to go to work. He's been retired for nearly 20 years.
Well, the thing is, that is their only correspondence and their only thing to, that's what they're clinging on to remain here, present, and it's the past. And it's just beautifully envisioned in this movie from his performance. And I turn around to Laura whilst we're watching this, and knowing that Laura has worked with people with dementia and has experienced it alongside it quite comprehensively herself, I said, is it all right for me to find their happening so endearing? There's something so endearing about someone who pretty much has lost their marbles, but there's an endearing thing there. And it's also, it's a question of human morality. These people are so far gone, but this is they're reaching out to establish that they're still connected to society and to the world. They are reaching out to establish a foothold somewhere
on their existence. The thing is, with people with dementia, they're funny. They don't mean to be, a bit like when a child swears and you try not to laugh because it just sounds so weird coming from their mouth.
Exactly.
It's very similar with those with dementia. We laugh with them because we laugh at something they say and they don't realise that they're being funny, and then they laugh too.
Yeah.
And what they do is endearing and it's sweet, and you just think, and you realise, you start to see, and it's amazing seeing these people, and amazing isn't quite the right word, but it's so fascinating, if you like, seeing these people who, I haven't known them all of their lives.
Yeah.
But you learn so much from them.
You pick up so many little pieces, you might as well have been there.
It's amazing. And
I
just,
you're living it with them.
You are. And Javier has done an epic job.
Well, I mean, if there's not been that many films, like certain movies are pushed out to get Oscar recognition, this is an Oscar film. I think this movie would never, in any light of day, would be recognised. It's so small.
There's no reason why it shouldn't be.
And particularly, lead actress is Elle Fanning, but they'll probably put that aside as supporting actress. She should have lead actress.
Mm.
But with Bardem himself, the performance, it's harrowing, it's heart-wrenching, but it's hilarious. Also the engagements of Elle Fanning, where she almost like a toddler, she has to make a game out of taking her own jeans off just to encourage her father to wiggle his own, because he ended up wetting himself up on having a checkup at the dentist. And it's the flitting in and out of time, a lot of people may find disconcerting, but you do piece it together like a puzzle. And it is fragmentary, and then there's also Salma Hayek, who is this great big presence as well, and also a great big presence in his life, of which when Laura Linney's character comes, goes, oh, he's talking about her again, is she? And Laura Linney is a bitch in this role, but it's a bitchy role that you can kind of understand where it's coming from. It's a life-affirming film. It is small, subtle, and it is epic in its vista of analysis, the existentialism, the humanity about regaining humanity whilst you don't really have that functionality. People around you, Elle Fanning's character is almost in denial about what is before her, her father. She doesn't ever mention it. It is like the elephant in the room. You do not mention it. Mm. And then people refer to him as if he's not there, and she takes great issue with that. And you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Talking as if he doesn't exist in that moment. And there's so many subtle little nuances and scenes and segments where Javier Bardem's character breaks out of it, but only for a macro second. It is a very subtle and powerful, endearing and extremely memorable performance. I mean, having someone play someone with dementia, and just, you know, throughout this, we're also savvy to the world and reality of Elle Fanning's character's life, and she's struggling, crying, having lost a really big job in journalism, a big story. Her father in the background is coming to this arrow point, this dead end, this almost arrow-pointed alley made out of trolleys. And just that subtlety of him just like in his own head, just lumbering
shuffling along.
It is just so on point. And in a lesser actor's hands, it would have been dialed up to 150 and it would have been terrible. It would have been a farce. It would have been comedic and not
it needs to not be
tasteful.
Subtle.
Yeah, it, not tasteful at all. In lesser actor's hands, with material like this and content, I know that all the actors here wanted to do their best to pay respects to it. The reality.
And they have. They truly have paid respect to every single person that has both suffered from dementia, and also the people that have watched their family suffer.
Who suffer the most.
Yeah, usually, because they're the ones that don't, you know, they feel like they're not recognised and they're not seen. And one of the loveliest scenes is when Javier Bardem, his character Leo, just turns around to his daughter and says, oh, Molly. And it's amazing, really, because you have that sudden realisation that he's, for the first time in a very long time, he's said her name.
He's snapped out of it a bit.
Just for a second.
And just she's so enamoured and so in love with her dad. She's always making sure that she's holding eye contact. It's like she's struggling. She's thinking,
How do I do this?
If she allows herself to disconnect like everyone else, she's very hands-on and physical. And that is her remaining with him, and that subtlety and that power in the performance. She always looks in his eyes and she needs to engage, and she is basically, her performance is screaming, Dad, come out, recognize me, come out, recognize me, I'm here. Oh, just talking about it, goosebumps. And if there are people struggling to go, oh, what should be nominated, this should be up there. Sally Potter has created a film that, though it feels long, It's not hampered by its vastness. It's the right duration. It's the right pace. Also, to do the score on her own as well, with all these other things that she's juggling. Sally Potter, I'm really impressed. I really hope that this gets recognition in some form. Mm. Because it is a sensational, heart life-affirming movie. For me, it's a 5-star film. For you?
It's a 5-star film.
5-star film. Could not recommend it highly. I mean, I went to my nan and granddad recently and told them about this, and nan turned around and she went, oh, they're both very similar movies. And anyone else would laugh at that and go, yeah, right, but they are. They're both life-affirming. Mm. They both talk upon certain topics. I'm not giving away too much about the Broken Hearts Gallery. There is a unity there. There is a, you know, there's not this shallowness. It's just, there's not a hollowness, whereas that is a vibrant, bubbly, reinforced, affirmative thing of live life, live full. Yeah. This film is also the flip side of regaining that type of quirk. And also,
it's different.
It's okay not to have the sparks in the life that you had before with this family member, but these moments yourselves, that with his dementia and his condition, you can still have those sparks, but in a different vein. Mm. You can have those moments that you will hold to your chest, where she's mourning the loss of her father. I think she realises herself as a character. you know what, these moments of endearment where he just goes off and shuffles off, Nesta, Nesta, and he's just giggling to himself because he's recalling something else, like, you see, you make the most of what you have,
yeah,
and you hold it to your heart, your chest, and you go, okay, I may be seeking the father that I had before, I'm going to take him in full. And that is a realisation. And there's that beautiful end point where it's a walk away moment. It was like a great transitional. This is us both looking on. I could walk away from this.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here with you, noticing with you in this moment. If I did do that, it would harm you, then do you any good. Beautiful, beautiful, harrowing, heart-wrenching, sublime. Watch it, please. Please watch it.
Okay, so The Grizzly Man?
Yes, The Grizzly Man. And then we'll go on to The Social Dilemma. Then Dez. We've got to talk about Dez.
Of course. So The Grizzly Man is a documentary about... can't remember his name. It's about a gentleman that went to live with grizzly bears for... was it like 13 years in the end?
However long.
And basically it was friends and family members basically talking upon the life that he led, Timothy Treadwell, the life that he led around living with these grizzly bears, and how devoted he was, and all these kind of different perspectives. For me... personally, I found some of the documentary very challenging. It was very interesting.
Well, I don't believe the issue came from inherently from Werner Herzog. It's just the side and aspect that he revealed with the certain interviewees that really bothered you. And their fulcrum of opinion and their perspective.
Yeah, so, you know, it was interviews interspersed with some of Timothy Treadwell's actual footage that he filmed himself, both earlier on in his kind of career and his life with grizzlies, and later on
his ever-evolving, you know, bond with what he was doing, which wasn't just the bears, it was nature, it was an evolution, it was a spiritual thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the biggest problem I had was that a lot of the interviewees were spending a lot of time almost trying to get justice for his death, almost trying to make it sound like it shouldn't have happened. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't believe that anybody should die, and I don't believe anybody should die in a cruel way. You know, we all deserve to live on this planet. But the way the interviewees made it sound was as if Timothy Treadwell was convinced into being put into this place and he died wrongfully. And the thing is all throughout the movie, it was very clear that this guy said, I live for these bears and I will die for these bears. Mm. And something that came to me whilst we were watching this film is that Steve Irwin died as a hero and Timothy Treadwell died as a tragic,
a nut job,
retarded event. Mm. And it frustrates me because, yes, it's different creatures, but both Steve Irwin and Timothy Treadwell, they knew what they were going into.
Yeah.
They knew the risks and they took those risks. And they both died from it.
Yeah, and they wouldn't have it any other way.
No, exactly.
That is the best natural fit, isn't it?
But why is one of them a hero and the other one is classed as a retard and it's a tragic event that should never have happened?
Well, the thing
is, it frustrates me.
A viewer, it is a tragic event that shouldn't have happened, but eventually it was going to happen. And he was not blinded, but he knew it.
He knew full well how dangerous these
were. He knew the foreshadowment. He even almost... and I heard Zog said something at a point, like... it was almost like he was leading himself to it. And it's like, he was.
Yeah,
and he says at one point, I think the closest I'll ever get to these creatures of understanding them if they fucking kill me and tear me apart.
And he said as well, he said, the only way I'm going to save this world, this planet, and this...
and make people see and be understood.
And this area for grizzlies, to conserve this area, is to die.
Yeah.
He said that nobody's going to understand this until I die.
And it did in a lot of ways. It did. It made it abundantly clear. This guy has been living with them for 13 years. You may believe he has an established bond with them, but at the end of the day, they're grizzly bears. They're wild animals.
And they will react on their animal instinct. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing. And it made it quite clear. You know, right before he died, there was a piece of filming that he did, and he was filming a bear that was diving right down deep into the river that he was looking for fish, because he was that hungry, and they believe that that was the bear that eventually killed him and his girlfriend at the time. And this is the thing, it's just like, but he was well aware of these risks. He took these risks, but the way the interviewees were talking was like, it shouldn't have happened.
It was a defined thing. I think that's why what I love about Werner Herzog as a filmmaker, he isn't a fence sitter. He doesn't lean one way or another. He lets everyone have their say. Mm. Others are saying he got a stick and he was poking them. He deserved it because he was a retard. He was a bit touched. He was with the fairies. Others thought his infatuation drove him to his demise. And then others, in their weird grandiosity, is like, There needs to be something done about this. Shit like this should not happen. He was aware of that. He did it. He made the decision. No one actually went out of the way to stop him. They benefited from it because they did view him as the kook, the local kook.
I think for me, I have a hunch that he was probably autistic.
There was some
He autistic. Struggled with physical human contact in some ways and preferred to be further down into nature than he did with humans. He had them as his friends. I'm not saying that that was wrong, but that's how he felt. Inside, he felt that he could be closer to bears than he ever could be with humans.
And he found an affinity with the land and the creatures. I mean, I think a spin-off documentary could be made called The Grizzly Foxes, because his
love for those foxes was just the same.
And then his heartbreak when one of the cubs, you feel it in your gut and you're like, and it's not, don't think this is me being detrimental or voicing my words with the interviewers, the negative ones, but it's come to that place. He's so far gone now beyond that rationale. He's as one with them in the nature, and you feel that. And it's not a detriment, I feel. He's come to this place where...
But do you not think that there is something about... We were supposed to be that natural. We weren't supposed to live in houses and have running water from taps. We were cavemen once. Mm. We used to live alongside these bears or things that are similar.
And that killed us, mammoths.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think there's part of me that sits
it's
here and thinks,
order,
actually...
in a weird way. He transcended the norm and went backwards.
But it's almost like he never really evolved enough. It's almost like...
Modern, yeah.
It's almost like evolution didn't quite hit him like the rest of it, like it has the rest of us.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why he's gone back to nature, because actually... His gut instinct isn't to sit.
That almost Neanderthalic nature.
Yeah.
Like they do say that murder comes from us, and our fear of the dark comes from that Neanderthalic years down the line. And I think he in a lot of ways, he transcended in his regression back into that because he was more safer in himself and secured, and he couldn't evolve with the modern norm.
No, and he said that himself. He said, I can't get used to that. Mm. It's not my way of living. And some people are like that because they've got more monkey, if you like, as a turn of phrase, more monkey in them than they have the evolved human. Mm. You know, the evolved human in us wants the central heating and the blanket. Whereas the more natural people that want to live out in the real world, they go and live with grizzlies.
Our simian years, it's.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. No. He still knew the risks, but he felt more comfortable
there. And I think a lot of interviewees did pipe up at some point, because in the cut, certain people I realised were of the mentality of it shouldn't have happened. And I had the same opinion as you, but there's this one man that later in the interviews, he's re-interviewed, and I think the context behind his opinion on that was about the girlfriend.
Yeah.
He was like, she didn't like grizzlies. She just wanted to be there with him because they were partners.
Yeah, but the thing is I've thought about that more, and I've thought, well, at one point, and there's not picture but sound that you never hear, but they give you like a commentary as to the actual physical death of the two humans. And Timothy shouts and screams at him.
Oh, yeah.
Screams at her, rather. Run. Get away. But she doesn't.
Exactly.
And that, for me, is enough to say, okay, neither of them deserve to die in that way.
No.
They were both too young in my eyes.
Yeah.
But if she really was as desperate as they say she was to not be around grizzly bears, why did she do it, and why didn't she run in the face of death?
Because she wanted to face those trials, tribulations. She wanted to face that almost spiritual rebinding, that, you know, Treadway did. And I think she was beholden to him, what he offered.
Yeah.
that vicarious living and along beside him, seeing the appeal of it.
Yeah.
And wanting to tailor herself to it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that harrowing moment where the realisation is when Werner Herzog just takes the headphones off and says, I can't listen to it anymore. Mm. He says to the woman opposite him, which was an ex, but also a family, he said, I recommend you get rid of this tape because it will haunt you and plague you, because those questions will come about. Why did you not run?
Yeah.
Why did you stay with him? But it's also, like you said, it brings that bit larger question. She was that scared of those animals, but she was willing to die with him.
Yeah.
So she was willing to transcend with him.
Yeah.
She was probably a more evolved, generationally woman as he was.
Mm.
And she kind of saw a purity in his regression, naturalism.
Mm.
And now a lot of people in this age of plant-based stuff and all that and lifestyles, reversion back into our long heritage, way in the caveman days, is more appealing and evolutionary and even transcendental and inspiring and all fitting and natural.
Not that we were
now
vegans at the time.
No, but you know, we were carnivores always. My point is being, in this technologically evolved world, people see regression as the pure peak of transcendentalism now. And I understand it, you see it, and I never feel in the documentary that Herzog ever wants to pinpoint, circle, put blame. He approaches it like most Herzog documentaries, on a spiritual, sometimes ethical level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Herzog is one of the best documentarians out there. For me, as a film fan of Herzog, he has made so many unbelievable documentaries. This one fell a little short for me personally with certain aspects of it, but there's no question inherent in this thing is a question of so many values, human.
Mm.
Also, a lot of things talking about hunting, about right and wrong. And what makes my initial like 3-star for this film go up is it opens up the floodgates to discussion like we've just had.
Yeah.
And perspectives and shifts and perceptions of it, that it's gone from a 3-star film where I go, oh, I felt a little bit more by your previous ones like Into the Abyss and The Cave of Forgotten Dreams. But I watched this and I thought, no, it's not about the filmmaking editorial ways. You're again, Zach, you're generalising through filmic terms. Look at this. It's a story being told to you concisely.
Mm-hmm.
And if that story and the reality, and it's not a story, it's a reality, the truth of this unfolding narrative opens the floodgates of these vital issues and conversations, well, it's a powerful documentary for me. So it is overall a 4-star film.
But I think the thing is, you know, from that, I think a lot of people are very, you know, like you said about right and wrong. I think there's an element that we need to remember that there is no right and wrong in nature.
Mm.
Because that is just how the food chain works. Mm-hmm. That's how surviving works. But yes, no, you're right. There's a lot of discussion that comes from documentaries like this.
So how many stars would you give it?
I personally give it 4.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because I'm not as I haven't watched as many documentaries as you have. So. I think perhaps it gets to a stage where you've watched maybe a few too many documentaries and it almost becomes like a samey thick situation.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like,
and
oh,
then
yeah,
those better ones that are like really go beyond the point and I'm like, fuck
yeah.
Yeah,
then they really stand out. Yeah. I think for me, I have watched a number of documentaries in my life, but not as many as you have. And so I think therefore it automatically becomes a higher thing because I think it's really interesting. And actually, I'm not here to review the fact that I hated what half of the interviewee said. That doesn't affect my scoring system, if you like. It's about how I felt about how it was created, which I thought was
and
very
how
gentle.
It opened up conversation for you.
Absolutely. So yeah, 4 stars from me.
Right.
So do you want to go Des or Social Dilemma?
I think this trickles out quite nicely to the Social Dilemma.
So,
Social Dilemma.
Okay, so Social Dilemma is a Netflix documentary that is around Facebook, social media, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, Twitter, and all the others that I can't think
Google.
Of right now.
Google. A lot is a lot of it stems from emails as well.
Yeah,
and the progenitor of it all.
Around the algorithms that create the different things you see online.
Sponsorships.
Adverts, sponsorships, those kind of things.
Social disintegration, social evolution, but in the digital age.
Yeah, absolutely. So
de-evolution as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was recommended to watch this by a colleague who is very much not active on social media. So I was a little wary of it at first because I thought, oh, it's just going
to
be...
It's appealed to you because you're, you're not part of that background. Yeah. You haven't got social media presence, so how could you understand it?
Exactly. But actually watching it hasn't massively changed my opinion on social media because I already knew there was something kind of fucked up and twisted about it. It certainly hasn't made me feel that I don't ever want to use social media again, nor has it made me feel that I want to delete certain accounts because there isn't really that concern.
Well,
for
that's
me.
I think this is the whole film's downfall. It wants you to change your opinion. And it wants to make an adverse effect where, well, you look at your phone, delete all your, put your phone down, go, I am not going near any of these things again, and it's like. But you're catering to the same nuances and algorithms because you are a streaming service, so get over yourselves.
Exactly.
Looking back on it, I really feel that this documentary hasn't got much to say because it's all been said before or we're all savvy to it, but because a certain generation is so encumbered with what they're doing and then they're so far inside it, they can't poke out for a little bit and go, oh, really, is that how it really is? I wouldn't know, because I'm benefiting from it. I mean, I'm part of the issue.
The thing is, for us, it's boring because we've heard it before.
We've spoke about it before.
But the problem is a lot of young people nowadays do not know how they're being manipulated and by whom or what.
No.
And this is the problem. I look at young people these days and they are obsessed with filters, Snapchat, Instagram, making themselves look less like themselves, thinner, different features, more exaggerated features in some areas.
Fitting into
and
that.
Less, yeah, exactly. And there was something.
And form.
And it was something that they called, was it Snapchat dysphoria or something similar? Around.
I can't fucking believe that's a thing, but I understand where it's come from and it is.
A lot of young people feel that they should be fitting into how certain people look and
this unreality.
Exactly.
That's not real.
But they don't realise that. And I think that's the thing, is people like us were very savvy to that kind of conversation and those kind of issues in life. But a lot of young people aren't. A lot of young people don't know what they're doing. And they're not aware of what they're doing until they feel so low, so degraded, so bad about themselves that they take their own life or they're being bullied and they can't understand why and all those kind of things. And it's because they are constantly being hooked by social media, by different people's opinions. And actually, it was very interesting to see how the algorithm works, because the algorithm is you know, it does affect me in the sense of I will get a message with, oh, so-and-so commented on so-and-so's post. Well, that was 3 days ago, you know? Just because I haven't been on Facebook for long enough today. And equally, you know, Facebook Messenger sends me a message to say...
Bugging their own systems to trick us into assuming it's a bug.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually kind of scary sometimes because I just...
It's manipulative and that's a high form. And their allegory and also... not allegory, their illusions... And not illusions, a fucking word. What's the word? Their comparisons, their analyses up against... magicians was the most compelling and supple thing for me when they went into that, and also the psycho geography of it all mapped out on a social platform, how a lot of this is psychologically based, and the simplicities of it and how it taps into so many deep rarefied things, also that the idea that artificial intelligence in of itself is trying to one up you or outsmart you or is trying to overall broaden you and envision you as this certain thing. To be honest, when it comes to my Facebook feed and all that and everything else, sponsorships and all that, it only caters to the offhand conversations I may have with Laura or maybe one other thing. It's really glitchy and offhand when it comes to me. Half the time it recommends stuff that I have no inclination for, but it's still I'm not saying that's not true for so many others.
Mm. Exactly, exactly.
And the dramatisation of that I thought was clever, the metaphor, the visual prismata of it, but again, the dramatisation ruined it for me.
There was no, I needed, as much as I don't ever want to watch things that are horrific and sad and that kind of thing, if you're going to put a dramatisation in it, it needs to be drama. That's the whole point of the word dramatisation.
To broaden and basically reinstall what the point you're making.
Exactly, and the point that they're making is that people are being manipulated into doing things they shouldn't be doing.
Culture wars, rallying.
Exactly, and fake, then suicide. And
fake,
stuff like that.
And as much as Trump has coined this term, fake news, when it's actually inherently tied to real fact, there is this thing of fake news. They brought up Pizzagate, of which someone actually went out with a firearm to shoot up a pizzeria because he thought
pizzeria.
It was a pizzeria because he thought it was a paedophile ring.
But that's the thing, is what we need to see in dramatisation is actually the real consequences of real life, but in a drama setting.
It's brain, and this is the thing. It is brainwashing. Social media, forums, trends, and this is why I get annoyed when people politicise everything and polarisation of it, and which they do cleverly get into. Politics doesn't have a place on Facebook. Politics doesn't have a place for the people unless it's democracy, but done in the right environment. Social media isn't the right environment to be political. It really isn't, because there's culture wars, there's rallies, there's
violence.
Yeah,
everybody is. This is the interesting thing. Facebook isn't the place for politics, yet that's where you will find most of your political views and arguments. It's horrifying. It's truly, truly horrifying.
And one person in this says, what is the culmination? And he says, civil war. Yeah. And I see that.
Yeah, I see that. And actually, you know, the guy that said that the world's going to end, effectively. We're gonna run out of actual human contact. And because we're so, and this is the thing, we're so detrimental to ourselves and to each other, because we're so busy trying to make ourselves look perfect and look good on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, that we're forgetting how to be human. And I've said this before, we're actually forgetting how to have human conversations, so we're going to forget how to reproduce as well.
Well, like this artificial intelligence augmentation between you and machine, it's a thing that science fiction writers have been talking for years, whether it's in the very outmoded, antiquated ways, like Isaac Asimov with his stories of artificial intelligence, like iRobot and his famous Foundation series, which is less about that, but more of his robot series, and also in the eyes of latest writers like Neil Asher, who writes Militia, Space Opera. He talks a lot about augmentation and it being an evolutionary chain of an event that is inherent. And but the thing is, what Neil Asher does, it has this optimistic spin on it, but there's no blindside in the reality that there is a pessimism. If it's to do with autocracy, if it's to do with democratization crumbling, and a lot of writers talk upon this, and a lot of writers may seem pro like augmentation. A lot of the time they're not pro augmentation, but by being storytellers and posing these questions, they use these devices to talk onto topics and vital issues. And this is what I thought was clever about those soul moments, dramatizations, about this analogy of these three clone people pulling the strings, and they are just one group of three out of 300 billion more, trying to tailor and specify this image of this boy, of what he looks like, who he is as an individual, but simultaneously crafting the person they want to craft, that they want to influence. It is about brainwashing. And though there's a lot of positivity about future augmentation, I don't believe in it. I think my brain is a glitchy computer as it is. Isn't everyone a glitchy computer? Yeah. Our brain is a computer in of itself.
Perfect, yeah.
Exactly. And augmentation is the fear, and I know that is like leaps ahead, but the real truth of the matter is, these people say that this isn't going to be our future, this reality, augmentation. Artificial intelligence isn't going to go the way you believe, because artificial intelligence, it has no rhyme nor reason, it just works, it's a program. It won't have a conscience. He says, but those people who are keeping that machine going, they do, and whilst they're doing it, they're losing their conscience, they're losing their self-consciousness, their self-awareness, and they're feeding into it. And a lot of the point is, we're not even going to get to this big futuristic stage that is written in books by Neil Asher or Peter F. Hamilton. We won't make it because of the disintegration of the norm of human engagement. We will be so inside ourselves via our cellular tabular devices, that human engagement will be void and all of it is going to be vicariously experienced and processed, i.e. we are going to become algorithmical to the big overall algorithm, and then the world will probably shut itself off along with us, and to the detriment or to the right, to the detriment or to the betterment, I think it's the betterment. And I think in the next 300 years, civil war will rise. I think that the norm will be not normal.
Not normal for us.
No. So this documentary does bring up vital issues, like we've had this discussion, but it's something that people like me, I'm well read. I read anything and everything. Science fiction, non-fiction. These topics and these issues are inherent. They are there. I'm aware of them. I talk about them. We have our discussions. So this is why the documentary fell flat for me. But the people they got involved, I felt was brave of them.
Oh, yeah.
And necessary of them.
Yeah.
People who are at the heart of this and who have created this. The one guy who says, I'm at work for 13 hours a day. I'm creating this system. I get home and I fall prey to it like everyone else. Yeah.
And the guy that had to write his own code in order to get him out of the addictive nature. And I thought that was so incredibly scary.
And the notion of addiction. Laura said to me, this is the new drug. It is the new fix. And when they talk about the...
I don't know what word you're looking for. Sorry.
The pheromone, what is it?
Dopamine.
Dopamine inside ourselves. It makes you go, oh, fuck. I mean, we all turn aside and go, well, I'm not that addicted. And Laura said to me, you are. I mean, I've been thinking this over the past, like, 20 hours. I'm like, yeah, in my own strand of it, that I'm not party to the culture war. I'm not part of that adapting yourselves. I'm still addicted to it to my purposes when it's book and film orientated. I am still addicted to that nature of it.
I think this is the thing, is a lot of people, first of all, get offended by the word addiction.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because addiction is related to cocaine and heroin. And I think...
It's a dirty word.
Yeah, it is. And I think also there are different phases of addiction.
Mm.
You've got the fact that I will look at Facebook at least once a day. So I have a form of addiction, but I'm quite happy to put it down. Other people struggle to not look at it, or
be away from it,
yeah. Want to be on it because they want to look at this, or they want to update that, or they want to see what this person's doing or that person's doing.
They want to share this reality of their life that isn't real.
Yeah, exactly.
And it feeds into that perpetual negative cycle.
And that was quite relevant. That was quite evident. It's getting my L's and my V's and everything mixed up. That was quite evident when you were saying the other day, I'm going to have 10 days radio silence from social media. And then within 2 hours you're on Instagram. I said, but that's social media. But the interesting thing is that your response at the time, and this is by no means a criticism, but a observation, your response at the time was, yeah, but I'm not updating anything. So, but that's not the point. You are on social media. Radio silence means off of it,
yeah.
Gone. You don't touch it.
Mm.
And I think that's the thing, is we forget, as a human race, we forget that addiction is the fact that you can't not be on it. No matter what you're doing on it, you can't not be on it. Yeah. And that is the thing that scares me.
Well, the thing is, I think that you yourself have a semi-addiction to it, not that you cater to anything of what is tackled in this. You always need your phone next to you, and I think that is a necessity and a reality born into you from your work.
Yeah, it is. And also, I spend a lot of time, because I'm very much the type of person that likes to learn things.
Mm.
I like to have knowledge, and especially like when we're doing podcasts and stuff, I like to be able to because I'm not very good at remembering actors' names, for example.
So information at hand.
So yeah, I like to have information at hand. So yeah, I do have my phone next to me a lot of the time, but you will notice that a lot of the time, probably 50% of the time, I'm not actually on it. It's just there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the difference. Whereas a lot of people
can't...
They can't put it down and stop.
Yeah.
I can quite happily go, it's there, and I know it's there, but I'm not going to need to use it.
Me too, pretty much. I mean, if I watch a film or something, I'm compelled to share what I've viewed for the day, but I don't spend hours up and hours up and hours up and hours up and hours on Facebook. Like, it's actually... Negatively, it's more commonplace and habitual. Log on Facebook. What notifications have I got? Okay, cool. Log off. 3 hours later, notifications. But I'm not compelled to do it. It's just second nature now.
But that's still, that's the addiction. That's the problem.
Yeah, but it might be. But to me and any other, to be honest, I don't think I'm addicted in the sense of what severity some people are. There's some form of it.
But that's what I mean. There's a spectrum of addiction.
Exactly.
And you've got people, so for example, my addiction is having my phone near me at all times. Your addiction,
but
I
you
think,
are,
is that...
But I don't think you realise either. You are on your phone quite a lot watching certain videos and certain things.
Yeah, but I think the difference is I'm not...
But why can't you be an addict?
I didn't say I wasn't.
It seems like you're throwing that out like...
But I've just said I'm addicted.
You didn't?
I did. I just said I'm addicted in the sense of I've always got my phone on me. And I was just about to say, I go onto Facebook and I do watch videos.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between that addiction and the addiction to comment on things, to like things, to share things.
Yeah.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
No. Well, the thing is, mine is always centred around supporting other artists, anything that fits into my interests.
But what I'm saying is it's not necessarily wrong. I don't like the fact that it becomes an addiction, though.
No. It's scary.
Yes.
It's not... It's not... It's not... It's not feasible. I don't think that's
what's
right.
Not feasible?
It's not feasible to continue living a life where it's dictated by technology. It's scary.
But what it's the fact that you're not aware of it. That's the biggest fear, I think, for me. It's not the addiction, but it's the denial of the addiction.
Yeah.
Now, I'm quite happy to sit here and say, like I said, yes, there is an addiction to the sense of I have to have my phone nearby. And I look at Facebook once a day. If not more, but I always look at Facebook once a day. That is a form of addiction.
Mm.
But I'm aware of it. So therefore...
When it transcends that, that's when you should be fucking scared.
Yeah, so when you don't realise what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, I'm kind of translating into that. Because now it's just like, commonplace.
Yeah, once you're done with Facebook, check Instagram. Once you're done with that, check Twitter. It's that kind of thing.
Well, to be honest, Twitter's too fucking busy for me. I was thinking of deleting it the other day because it's just always busy and full of nonsense.
But that's the thing, is that there's a transition between knowing your addiction and the denial of your addiction. And that's where a lot of people struggle with addiction.
And
is the acceptance and denial situation.
And you brought something up yesterday as well, not helped by what's going on.
No, it's not. Because the thing is now we can't see more than six people. So we've got more group chats. We've got more Facebook friends, people that we're communicating via Facebook, via Instagram, via Twitter. And it's actually kind of scary because it's just like, well, now that we can't see them in person, we're not seeing them in person. So now we're just going to keep going. Now, that's the thing. Once it becomes a habit to talk to someone via Instagram, are you really going to make that much of an effort to go and see them in person? Probably not.
Probably not. Social dilemma, freestyle film. There's certain topics, of course, that are broadened, and a lot of people go, but one minute, you can take it upon yourself to go, oh, I realise there's so much more to the grizzly man. The thing is, I'm aware and savvy to the issues. I write about it myself, my works enough to, you know, be self-aware of it, semi. So when I approach this, you know, it's not issues that I haven't been aware of. Me and Laura watched a documentary that brought up the same subject called We Live in Public, which was made 10 years ago before the more extremes of Facebook and Instagram ruled the world, about this man's total inebriated state of having to have a weird public internet-based platform. So when it comes to approaching it, I do feel like this documentary is a bandwagon and thing, and people are going to be all snooty nose like, oh, you do now, I watch The Social Dilemma and the issues are onto me. And it's like, you wouldn't have this conversation any other fucking day though, would you?
But the difference is, like I said, is the being able to say I've watched The Social Dilemma and I'm aware of the issues and still being in denial about your own addiction.
Yeah.
There is the difference.
Yeah.
Again, it's the same thing. You can sit there and be all snooty and up your own backside and say, oh, look at me, I've watched The Social Dilemma. I know all about the algorithms and the problems it causes. Are you still addicted? Yes. Are you still in denial about it? Yes. Right, well, then go away, sort that out, and then come back and be snooty. That's the difference for me personally.
Yeah. How many stars would you give it as a film?
Three.
I'd give it three.
The subject in which it was talking upon was very interesting. Some of the things that I kind of knew but was confirmed in my head was very interesting, but the actual dramatisation and the actual production of the documentary for me was a little shabby.
Yeah. So yeah, Social Dilemma, that is 3 stars from Articulate Warbling.
So last but by no means least is Dez.
And after that I'm gonna need to make an apology about a previous episode, but we'll go with Dez.
Oh Christ, what did you do now?
Oh, I just said once someone's name wrong and also gave out the wrong information.
Okay. So Dez is a 3-parter docuseries
from ITV
about Dennis Nilsen,
mm-hmm.
And his murder spree in the 1970s/80s,
mm-hmm.
And how he may or may not be entirely fucked up.
And his relationship with the author who brought him to much more acclaimed notoriety and basically encouraged the worst out of Nilsen post murder is Brian Masters, who wrote Killing for Company. David Tennant is sensational in it. He is a chameleonic actor, a bit like Michael Sheen, who he starred opposite in Good Omens, which is a whole other story, which we will not get into. They're both. Tennant is recognisable easily. He's a very particular looking person.
And he's very Scottish.
Very Scottish. He also stands out from a crowd. Not just because of the fame from Doctor Who, but everything he does. But he's a chameleon. He can take on the flesh and the existence and the soul of every character he inhabits and performs. And he is great as this character. And even compels you to believe that even though this character isn't in his right frame of mind, that perhaps this killer, deep down inside himself, has a soul. And is pleading for people to stop him. Well, the reality is, no, he was a manipulative, fame-seeking twonk when everything kind of came about. And it's just a very compelling crime procedural based upon a real event. Paul Tone recommended I watched it. He also recommended I actually buy the book Killing for Company by Brian Masters because it offers more insight on a one-on-one basis. And then the television series would. But Tennant is, give the guy an award, give the guy a pay rise. I mean, the guy is a terrific actor. Also, the actor who plays the head detective of it, who always plays wet wipes and always pushovers and TV series, a very, quite well-known British actor who's always on the fringes of films, but is never the centre of them. I think he's even in Fisherman's Friends. I don't know his name.
Daniel Mays,
of whom, you know, isn't so much a wet wipe in this. It's and even though it's based upon real events and crimes, there is a dramatisation to it, of course. It is a television drama. But it's compelling, and it taps into that thing of all of us.
It was in 1917, wasn't it? Unfortunately, sorry.
I don't know what I'm saying. He was There's overt dramatisation, but there's a certain, always vicarious intrigue of anything serial killer related or crime related. Like, the new era of this generation, a lot of youth are, you know, engaged and involved and obsessed with series, documentaries, centred upon wrongly or rightly accused murderers. And I think it comes to a place of vicarious living. We can live that moment, but distance. And also the overall complexities of the person's mind. I think, like, serial killer documentaries and series is, for entertainment purposes, you know, compelling, not just to showcase an actor's talent, but also taps into the psychology of us as human, open up topics and discussions that maybe this era of viewers and, you know, the youths and millennials, of whom are gravitating towards it, seem to be infatuated with, but in the right way, not thinking that they want to be murderers, but are tapping into the psychological topics of discussion. I think it's something that's relatively necessary. I think it opens kids and teenagers' minds to the reality of the world we live in, and also the question of morality. And I think these types of documentaries and series rightfully or wrongly, if they're dramatised or not, I think that the new impetus and the new culture and trend and fashion for millennials to love these series isn't because they've got a weird sadistic kick out of it and it's all to do with vicariously living through them, like, oh, posing the question of would I go that far, could I be capable of it? Well, we do have those conversations, we've had them ourselves. It's about also looking at something so unbelievable, so captivating, so enthralling, but so disturbing that it does make you question vital elements to what it means to be human. And I think it's the type of conversations and inner existential evaluations and maybe self-reflective type things that it's quite good for the generation to be. So I think this new fad and trend of people being obsessed with serial killers isn't detrimental. I think it will open up their minds a little bit more to discussion, debate, and also open themselves up a little bit more about the weird grey ground between good, evil, or evil and good, and the more extremes, just pure devil incarnate. But
I think it raises questions as well around psychosis and whether there's a difference, and I believe there is, whether there is a difference between being psychotic enough to be a killer and being psychotic enough that you...
aren't accountable for it.
Yeah, exactly. And that you... there's a special phrase for it that I can't remember the name of in the court of law. Mm. They use a special phrase for people that are... basically not accountable for what they've done due to their mental health issues. And I think this plays a lot on that, and he played a lot on that, because he's basically saying, like, I'm not accountable because I'm too mentally ill. And he's absolutely not. He is mentally ill in some ways because he is psychotic and he has murdered these people for absolutely no reason, but not psychotic enough that he could be basically considered to be too ill to know what he was doing.
Yeah, not be held accountable. But the thing is, from the off, like, even the coppers from the off, they're like, he's played us from the beginning, he's played us, and now he's fucked us over. It's been a game to him. I think as soon as he realised, I think Brian Masters, I think that's his name, when he came to realise that, oh, this guy has just been leading us along. When he realised he was caught, he had everything strategised. He threw out false information. I've killed 16 people, when it actually turned out he killed 12 or 13. It shows you to the ends that these people will... You think, how more... How it shows the levels these people will go continually.
Mm.
You've killed and damaged hundreds of people through your actions.
Yep.
And you're still going to prolong this heartache by false information, lies, and straddling it out. That's the problem with Rose West. She's still accountable for all those murders, but she is holding it tight to her chest. Her lips are sealed because it keeps the attention on her and it keeps the expectation going. And also, she has an ace up her sleeve. And she can pull that out at any moment, whether she's going to take it to her grave. And a lot of serial killers get that kick out of that. Whereas I think there was a lot more emotional trauma on Dennis Nielsen's side when it came to why he killed these boys. It was killing for company. It was about having those people beside him. And there's a lot of information about him as a child, seeing a relative dead, also having nightmares about a dead child, a dead boy and a body being more precious and personified in a dead vein than alive vein.
And I think that is, I think there are a lot of mental health issues, but that doesn't mean
he shouldn't be held accountable. He's too self-aware.
Diminished responsibility is the phrase I was looking for. It doesn't mean that he's any less
guilty
for what he's done. And this is, and
he's too hyper-aware.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Is like I said, is the difference between diminished responsibility and knowing exactly what you're doing but still being a fucking weirdo, a psychopath, a totally fucked up in the head situation. And that's the thing, is, but he was so aware of what he was doing.
He hid bodies, didn't he? Yeah. And then would take them out off and on when dictated that he was in the mood, and he would clothe them and sit them next to them and wash them and bathe them. But he, in his weird fucked up agenda, was I would never penetrate something as beautiful as those bodies. And it's like, well, that ain't signal enough. Well, I don't know what it is. But it's
not diminished responsibility. No. That's the thing. And I think the thing is he's...
Oh, he played that?
Yeah, he absolutely did. And he said at the end, he said... Because there was the guy that was, in fact, one of his victims, but he was taken off the witness stand because what he was saying was what he'd been told to say, effectively.
Mm.
What the news had revealed about things. And Brian Masters turned around to him and he said, well, was he your victim? He said, yeah.
But not as he said it.
Exactly. And that's the thing. That's not diminished responsibility. No. That's just playing. That's manipulative and controlling and scarily psychopathic.
I know, but...
It was kind of funny in a way.
No, the thing is, this is what I was going to say. This is what is such compelling drama, because he's done these things. He's based up on a real person, but you can understand why Brian Masters was so taken by him. He's oddly compelling.
And he's so truthful. Yeah. I think that's the thing I found difficult, because it was the way he said, yeah, it did happen, and he is one of my victims, but it didn't happen like that. Because it's almost like, I will admit to the things that I've done, well, although he didn't, but if you've told it in the wrong fashion and it didn't happen like that, I don't want that to be out there. And it's like, actually, I can kind of understand that.
He's led them by the nose, and when he didn't get what he wanted from that police officer in the case, I want to know how my dog's doing. He's like, I'm not playing these games with you. He's like, okay, I'm going to play a bigger game with you. I'm going to go up on that stand.
I'm not going to say not guilty.
And not guilty, and then basically turn around and basically make the copper in question himself, going, could I have made this better if I played on his ground terms? You may have been able to, mate, and you could have done, but there's no guarantee that he wouldn't have continued playing these games and elongating it for as long as is possible. And then the ultimate confrontation, as dramatised, he says, it's good you got me, because by this point it would be 150, 100, 152. But the way Tennant plays it, he's likeable.
Yeah.
Because of his honesty.
Yeah.
And his brute force and his bluntness and his objective standing. And he can also be subjective in a way.
Yeah.
It's really engrossing.
I think as well, the best thing for me about this specific one is that I hadn't heard a lot about it before I watched it. And I think that's the thing.
Even though before, you mentioned him before, ages ago, you were like, the guy who boiled hands and hid bodies, put bodies down a drain. And then when I told you about this, you're like, I never said that.
Yeah, well, I don't recall it, so. But, you know, that's the thing, is that the more you hear about a murderer and then you see the documentary, you're like, oh, this is so boring. Because you've heard it all before, you've read the book, you've watched 5 documentaries about it. And you're like, this one's just the same old.
Yeah.
Whereas this was different because you don't hear so much about it. So when you watch it, you're like, whoa.
Well, the dramatisation is very left ambiguous there. They slide in certain things that is obviously inherently pulled from the book, like this form of engagement. Like, there's a lot of criticism to the dramatisation from the people in the reality of it. They said, I didn't say that. And they said, no. We've taken conversations between Brian Masters and Dennis and we've translated them into these characters because we need to dramatise it. Because if we showed it how it was,
it's boring.
In a documentary side of things, that's where you get to tell it how it is. And they did do a companion documentary of Tennant narrating it. Also, people still recommend, they say, as much as Brian Masters can be held accountable for the furthered ego, I've got everything, I've got the power here type thing, because he encouraged that engagement with Nielsen. That book is still a great source, a great insight, because Dennis offered so much candidness, but also Brian Masters I think he got to a stage himself as a writer and as an individual and human where he realised that Dennis is telling him, he's telling him what he knows Brian wants to hear. He's telling him what he knows will be good, juicy, meaty stuff. And he also felt himself and posed questions in the book, apparently, where he goes, is what he's offering me, is this candidness or is this embellishment? Or is this another veneer of fiction? And the most intriguing thing about this, the crux point that makes it even more interesting, this was all discovered because a dino rod man found a blockage.
Yeah.
The blockage was reported by Dennis Nielsen, no less.
Mm-hmm. He wanted to be cool, so he could play the games. It was all about the media coverage.
I think initially he didn't do it because he wanted to be famous. I don't think he did it because he wanted media coverage, but I think he got to a point where he maybe questioned something in himself, and maybe because he's so totally in and out of it, like he used to say, it was almost like a disembodied thing that I was just compelled to do it. I had to. Like, there's always an indication that if anyone wanted to leave, that's when the murder happened. They showed that. And it seems to be a thing of, if you don't play by Dennis Nielsen's rules, you're going to die. And then there was this weird infatuation with resuscitation, strangulation, asphyxiation, and glorifying drowning people's bodies having been drowned or killed. And It's just a very, and the thing is, it's a paradox unto itself. Information afforded, conversations gleaned, different people's perspectives. You will never ever get the full rounded story or reality of what it was or what the impetus was, because you're not that person. And that's what makes documentaries, that's what makes different books, perspectives. This is why these types of things go on for so long, and probably for so long, that, like you said, it gets boring. Because what is the truth? What is the hard fact? And the man said, what do you think, the head copper in real life, they said to him on the stand, they didn't put it in the documentary, didn't put it in the drama, which I thought they should have, because it cuts Nielsen down. They said to him, how do you feel about him, having engaged with him? And he just said, unremarkable. And that like cut Nielsen, like cut him deep, because he likes to think of himself as this, I'm a normal guy, I'm just your average Joe, I work at the job centre, whereas you know he's got delusions of fucking grandeur in his head. And then he says, why didn't you use their names? I think you're just you're fucking disrespectful for not naming these poor people I fucking killed. It's more disrespectful not to name them than to misname them. And it's just like, you are one twisted, manipulative fuck. And you are rationalising all these irrational actions and things to fit your fine point. Did he want to be seen as a normal person with outside taboo taste? Did he want to be seen as a murderer? Did he want to be seen as a victim? No, I think he just wanted to be seen as the full him, but as dictated on his fucking terms. And it's a sensational, gripping three-part drama. If you can get hold of it in America, I think you'd be able to get hold of it on BritBox, because that's out there as well. Or you may have seen it. I think they've got ITV channels out there, American style, haven't they?
I think so.
Well, if you can get a hold of Dez, a three-part crime series based upon the Dennis Nielsen murders, David Tennant, I recommend you watch it. Now, again, like, I can go warbling on about all these different things, but in true fashion, how shall we round this up for you, this conversation?
Oh, I think we should just rate it, to be honest. I'd just say it's very, very much recommended to watch. There's very little else we can say, really. It's fucked up, but it's a bloody good drama. It's really fucking interesting. It's a five-star watch from
me. And it's just the topic of it, of discussion. It can go on and on and on.
Well,
and
you can argue from every corner until you're black and blue.
And we'll never get to any enlightened source point. No. That goes with them as soon as they either top themselves or die. And
which he has.
He's dead now, yeah. But still doesn't take away the sadness of it all. But also, a lot of people say, oh, I don't understand how people get a weird kick and a weird fascination with these types of stories. The poor family members. Yes, the poor family members. And that is a lot of the time where we come from as viewers and are able to sympathise. The imagining of, fuck, imagine if this happened to us. It's inconceivable. I had something on the tip of my tongue I was going to say, but it's gone now. I don't want to extrapolate this any longer. Dez, highly recommended. And yeah, Dennis Nielsen, what a fucking cunt. So, before I go out and we end this episode, apologies to Ryan Madej, not Madej. I was really dead certified that I pronounced his name right.
And also, I backed you up, so apologies, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan. Also, I know some publishers. Because Ryan's books are spread here, there, everywhere with their sources, the majority of his works are readily available on Amazon. So I said that the Marianas Trench was available on Amazon. Not so long after my podcast was put out, the publisher released a comment, basically, not directed at me, but I knew it was kind of like in reaction to me fucking up. They're like, the book is available on lulu.com, just for your information. And I was like, fuck.
Oopsie.
Oh no, I said Amazon. Now, the Marianas Trench is available on lulu.com. There, I said it. I did it right. Ryan Madej.
Now, mate, it sounds much better than Madej, though.
I love Madej.
No.
Madej.
It felt a little bit too clunky for
me.
Well,
I tried to reassure Ryan. I said I have met M.R. Tapia, Manuel Tapia, of whom I called Manuel.
Well, it's just the same as you've been calling.
Or Manuel.
But it's just been the same as you've been calling Javier Bardem, Javier Bardem.
Javier Bardem. He's a javelin type Mexican so, Spanish actor.
Ryan, if it's any consolation,
it's Zach not just
has
you,
been calling Javier Bardem, Javier Bardem, and that I think is slightly more insulting.
Look,
than Mad
Dash. I'm a writer. I'm a writer. I don't have to pronounce things properly because
shittest excuse known to mankind.
You can pronounce anything which way. I mean,
incorrect though.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
You can pronounce whatever the fuck as you want.
In your home, yeah, sure.
I mean, like, you can be self-reverential about it eventually, like me, when I came to realise that I was making myself look like the biggest twat ever by saying Forks Pass instead of Faux Pas.
And Jacqueline Phoenix, which is Joaquin.
Joaquin Phoenix, I know, Jacqueline Phoenix. You know, I'm not the smartest guy.
No comment.
Fuck you.
You were looking for a comment, though. You went silent looking for something. So I just fed the space.
I am the smartest guy. I'm just stuck in my ways. Anyway, thank you for joining us for this all sorts episode. The thing is, we don't have any dates. We don't do it every week. I mean, if we did it every week, it would be pointless.
Boring,
there'd be nothing, to,
there's
talk
nothing
about,
to talk about.
And we would just run ourselves dry. You're putting your hands up for Detroit. I love this city!
Yeah, just to say, I'm very nearly towards the end of my book, which means that I will be able to review the Twilight series books and also Raw by Cecilia Rahan very soon.
On that episode, I'm also going to join you in reviewing a few books. The Edge Chronicles, the latest and final Edge Chronicles book, going into a little depth about my relationship with it, and I want you to do that likewise with the whole Twilight Saga thing.
Yep.
But anyway, thank you for joining us. This has been a good one, I think.
Yes.
I mean, every time when it fizzles out in the last 15 minutes, Laura's just like playing with her hair, tweaking her nipples, lifting one up, smelling beneath it, going, that smells quite nice.
I could lift my boobs up. Jesus, if they were big enough to lift, I'd be out there juggling them about.
Where's your mum gone?
To the shop.
Oh. She's been gone a long time for just potatoes.
Yeah, she also has a very flat tyre. So she would have had to drive very slowly.
Oh, really? Has she?
She wouldn't let me follow her, so.
How do you know?
Because she told me earlier. So I said, do you want me to follow you to the shop? She went, no. So I'm having.
Why doesn't she get a new tyre?
Well, she might have to. We'll see.
Anyway, next time, will Jane survive the flat tyre?
Oh, God.
Join us for the next episode of Jane is Stuck in Traffic with a Flat One. Anyway, bye, guys. Lots of love.
Bye.
I haven't even hit the button yet. Bye!